Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center in New York. And we usually broadcast out of Roberta's, but we are so lucky today because we're down at the Charleston Food Festival, and we're sitting at the Planters Inn in Charleston, South Carolina. And I have probably Mr. Charleston himself, the chef that's, I don't want to say put Charleston on the map, because Charleston's been on the map for a culinary map, especially for many, many years. But Sean Brock has probably reintroduced, redefined, and re-energized the scene in Charleston, South Carolina for many of us.
Oh, geez.
And Sean, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's really a great honor to have you on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
And I don't want to say I'm a Yankee, but I'm a Yankee from New York City, and I'm just loving it and learning so much, and I just want to kind of extract from you everything I possibly can about this incredibly fertile, fantastic, delicious place. So, you're native, right?
I've been here 10 years. I'm originally from Virginia, but, you know, 10 years is a long time to live in one place, and I'm pretty positive this is the only place I'll ever live.
Really?
Oh, I'm in love with it. How could you not love it? I mean, it's just an amazing place to live, and it's one of those cities where if you live here, you're proud to live here, and I think that's one of the major reasons everyone is so nice here. I mean, everybody's just in a good mood because they're happy they live here.
That's not just the South.
I think it's the South, but there's something just so charming about Charleston when you realize you live in a city that's so beautiful and gorgeous with such a rich history. You know, there's people come here to, you know, you live in a place that's a tourist destination. You know, that's very cool.
So, tell me about what part of Virginia were you born and raised in?
I grew up in the coal fields of southwestern Virginia. It's a very interesting place to grow up, deep in the Appalachian Mountains. Extremely interesting way of life. Way of life is extremely old-fashioned. Doing things, living off the land and growing your own food and preserving and hunting and fishing, and really almost kind of being out of touch with the normal world.
How big a town was it?
Town that I grew up in has a population less than 1,000.
Really?
You know, so it's extremely small town. The best way to paint the picture is if you've ever seen Coal Miner's Daughter.
Yes.
That's basically where I'm from.
Wow. So what kind of food did you, did you go hunting?
Yeah, well, Appalachian sort of heritage cooking is fascinating. It's extremely humble cuisine, but it's really fantastic and delicious. And that's really what I plan on spending the next probably 10 years of my life studying and trying to document. And trying to master, you know, it's all the stuff that I grew up eating. And luckily, my mother lives in Charleston now as well, and so any opportunity we get, we cook together, and I'm always trying to replicate the dishes of my childhood.
Tell us some of the dishes.
Well, you know, the food, it's extremely vegetable-based. And a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people think about, when they have this idea of Southern food, it's fried chicken, it's barbecue, it's all these things that are unhealthy. Well, I mean, we rarely ate meat as a kid. If we did, it was the result of a hunting trip or a fishing trip. It's a lot of vegetables. You live out of the garden, and then when the garden's not booming, you eat out of the basement. You have all these mason jars everywhere and these crocks of fermented foods. And so, you know, a standard meal would be several vegetables and cornbread and lots of pickles and preserves and a huge table, a huge display of all these things, and lots of raw vegetables. Actually, there was always a plate, when the ingredients were in season, of course, of sliced tomatoes, raw green onions, raw cucumbers, and raw banana peppers. That was like a mainstay at every meal, and it was very interesting to watch these old the old people eat there. They all eat this very interesting way. So you have your plate, and you'll have, say, in one corner, you'll have some braised, slow-cooked beans. Then you'll have fermented corn. Then you'll have a fresh vegetable. And then you'll have a piece of cornbread. And it's funny to watch all these old people eat. And I eat this way now as well. It's like it's very thoughtful. It's like you take a bite of beans, and then you take a bite of onion. That flavors the bean. And then you take a bite of the sauerkraut. And then you take a bite, a slice of tomato, and that freshens it back up. And it's just, you watch the bite patterns of people, like the eating pattern. And it's funny, I noticed it when I was a little kid, and I eat that way now as well. But I've had several conversations with other people from that area, and that subject comes up a lot. It's fascinating. I mean, that culture, I'm scared of it dying. I mean, there isn't really a chef who's like really, really embracing that region and trying to preserve that food. So I think I'm going to try to.
As you have in Charleston. Well, tell me, were you a good student when you were in school? What did you think of school?
You know, I was that student who had to make 100 and an A, or I would just like be, you know, I would be devastated. So I took school, and it was so important to me, and I loved it. Like, I loved being in school, and I loved getting good grades all through high school. I was the long-haired kid with the Volkswagen van making A's.
Really? Yeah. I was going to say, shock me. I just had Matt and Ted Lee here, you know, which was a good one, which was a, you know, naughty one. And what were your dreams in high school? I mean, were you loved to eat, but was food on your radar? Was it just something you took for granted?
No,
what were your aspirations other than food?
You know, honestly, I've always known I was going to be a chef.
Really?
I knew when I was 11 or 12 years old, I already had my own pots and pans and woks and was cooking huge meals and glued to the TV watching Justin Wilson and Julia Child and Yan Ken Cook and watching great chefs and just like daydreaming about what it was like to put on that starched white coat and that tall funny hat and handle razor sharp knives with all the stainless steel everywhere and the hum of the hoods and all these people under your command, you know, waiting for a job, that's always fascinated me. So I've always kind of been that way and thought that way, but I did go through a period where I thought I was going to play in a rock and roll band and be successful, but that certainly didn't turn out.
What instrument?
I play guitar. Well, I collect guitars now. They sit at my house. But I love music. I love music as much as food, and which is one of the reasons why I'm so excited about our new place in Nashville. Is, you know, music is such an important thing to culture, and that's what fascinates me these days, is trying to understand culture and how each individual culture is formed. And once you start trying to look at things that way, especially in the South, you realize how incredibly diverse it is. You know, even if you look at Mississippi, there's several kinds of blues from Mississippi. There's several kinds of cuisine, and you'll start, and you can go through all the states and look at it that way. And I think that's what to me is so wonderful about the South, is you need a lifetime to study it and to understand it.
So, this town of 1,000, did they have any restaurants that had white toqued chefs in it?
We didn't have a restaurant. We had one crummy grocery store. I didn't eat at a restaurant that was not like a chain steakhouse, and probably until I was 16 years old. we just cooked at home. And if you think about it, it's kind of a European lifestyle. Like, you know, in the country, you eat off the land and you cook all day long, and you eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner with your family around the table, and you never go to restaurants. And I thought that's the way everyone lived, you know, because seriously, like, way back in the mountains, I really thought that's how everyone lived.
So you saw these chefs on TV, and it was even, because you said you didn't eat in a restaurant until you were 16, really, that's... But you're saying when you're 11 or 12, you were dreaming of being a chef.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
so was that a not? I don't want to say fairy tale, but was it?
No, it was a dream.
It was a dream.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, it's like.
So, how did you make that dream come true?
Well, I attached myself to my grandmother and my mother, and I just spent as much time in the garden and in the kitchen. You know, when I was a kid, all of my chores that I had to check off every day before I could play Mario Brothers or wiffle ball,
yeah,
or things in the garden or with food. You know, I'd have to pick lettuces or dig onions or dig potatoes and wash them or crack walnuts or string beans or shuck corn. You know, I always had my hands on food, and I loved it, and especially working in the dirt. I'm still the same way. Like, that's just an extremely pleasurable thing for me, being in the dirt and the smells and the food and the vegetables, and I was very lucky to grow up that way. So my grandmother saw that. She saw how excited I would get when I would eat a potato right out of the ground. She saw how excited I would get when I would eat the corn right in the field, and so she immediately started teaching me as much as possible, gave me my own knife, letting me chop at a very young age, and just started teaching me all these things. So, you know, it's like a rite of passage. It's like you learn her technique for biscuits, her technique for cornbread, her technique for sauerkraut, her technique for canning, for making pickles, her technique for chicken and dumplings.
How did you leave your town? What age were you?
Well, we left Wise County, Virginia, when I was 11 or 12, and we lived in West Virginia for a couple of years, but then we lived in a town called Abingdon, Virginia, and there were lots of great restaurants there, and I was 15, so that's when I got my first job in the kitchen at the hardware company restaurant, washing dishes, and I would just sit there and wash dishes and just stare at the guys on the line, you know. And this is like one of those kitchens where everybody on the line's got just dressed in all black, black headbands on, long hair, Metallica's blasting on the stereo, the pack of Marlboro Reds is on the station, and these guys are just flaming things and just super busy restaurant. And I would just sit there and just like in amazement, like, that is exactly what I want to do.
All right, the testosterone's ripping down the walls.
Exactly. That's exactly what I want to do.
Right.
And I just, you know, showed how hard I could work in the dish tank, and eventually worked my way through the kitchen, all the stations, and eventually got the respect from everyone and learned how to cook on the line and deal with tickets and juggle a million things at once, and that's when I decided that you know, once I graduated high school, I wanted to make the commitment and spend the money on a great culinary school. And I made a big list of all the great schools and mapped out this sort of road trip that I was quite excited about, but the first stop was Charleston, South Carolina, and Johnson & Wales University. Mm-hmm. And I didn't go anywhere else. Like, the second I came to the city and started walking around the streets, I was like, there's no need to go anywhere else. This is where...
In love.
Yeah, absolutely. It was love at first sight. And so I went to school here and ironically worked at the restaurant that's on this water bottle, Peninsula Grill, which is inside the Planters Inn where we are right now. And that's where I really got my training and tried to understand what the word chef meant, you know, what it meant to wear one of those hats and what it meant to cook at that level and that level of consistency and deliciousness. And that was a life-changing experience for me, for sure.
All right, well, we're going to take a little break here, and when we come back, we're going to get into what does it mean to be a chef.
Uh-oh.
And Chef Sean Roth.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today, I'm interviewing the great chef of Husk Restaurant and others in his past. The James Beard nominated and winner for the best Southeast. I think you're up for best outstanding chef in the country this year.
Boy.
The much, much heralded and acclaimed Sean Brock from Husk Restaurant in Charleston, South Carolina. We're following his story. And what does chef mean to you? How was it when you were 11 thinking about it, and then now you're working in a restaurant and understanding what it is? We have a lot of listeners out there who would love to be a chef. What does it mean to be a chef?
Oh, that's an amazing question. You know, the definition of that word and the job duties involved with that profession have changed quite drastically in the last 5 years, even. It used to be much easier. Your job was to cook delicious food and to feed people. Now it's much, much different. I think the general public's becoming more and more educated about our food system in America, and they want to know. They have lots of questions, and they want to know the answers, and they're turning to chefs for that knowledge. So now we have a lot more responsibilities. I mean, you know, we are concerned with soil health. We are concerned with with our waters, you know, and how animals are raised and how vegetables are grown. And I know what a lot of people don't realize is the amount of charity work that we do. I mean, I spend probably 50% of my time doing charity work and helping people in need through food. And more and more chefs are doing that these days, and some a lot more than others, certainly. But, you know, these days, it's to the point where we're going to Senate. We're being trained to speak, you know, in Washington about laws about antibiotics and food and just farm bills, and it's amazing.
Policy.
It's not. Yeah.
Do you think? I think that's it's a wonderful opportunity for chefs, but for people that are thinking about becoming a chef, what is it that, how do they pay their dues? What do they have to do?
Well, I think the most important thing is to set an extremely long-term, unattainable goal.
Unattainable.
Exactly.
Why?
Because it's all about the push, it's all about the drive, and it's all about trying to get there. And you'd be surprised if you're seeking something that's unattainable, such as perfection. You'd be surprised how much more harder you try every single day. And you know, the thing about being a chef and what it takes to be a chef is extremely complicated. I mean, you have to know what you want in the end. You know, like when you're sitting in the rocking chair with a gray beard and overalls, you know, telling your story, you have to put yourself there first, and then you work backwards. For me, I always knew what that story was, and you got to work towards that. And each person's going to have a different story they want to tell, and that's how you set yourself up. And then you have to realize that. I was 34 2 days ago. I just turned 35 yesterday, and I've been cooking since I was 15 years old. That's over half my life, and it's a commitment, and it's a commitment that isn't easy, but is always fun and always rewarding.
Tell me, Husk is such a beautiful, interesting. It was one of the most exciting menus I have seen.
Oh wow! Thank you.
You know, and I get around, but that menu, I could have eaten half the dishes right then, and you know, wanted to take the other half home. Tell me about Husk. Tell me how it came about and what it is that you're doing there every day.
Well, I've been at McCrady's for 7 years, which is in this beautiful 18th century building, and we're trying our best to cook refined and creative food. And one day I was working, and the president of the neighborhood dining group that operates and manages McCrady's and Husk now, obviously, David Howard, said, let's go take a walk. I want to show you something. So I put the knife down, and we went walking down Queen Street. And I park about a couple blocks away, and my walk to work every day is Queen Street. And every day I really enjoy the walk and looking at the buildings and the architecture and trying to figure out what year it was built and which style of architecture it was. And so I was explaining all that to him, and he's just listening. And we get to what is now Husk. At the time, it was an old home that was literally, you know, homeless people were actually living in it. And the bar beside it is this, our bar at Husk is this beautiful little brick building. And that building had always caught my eye because it was falling over and it looked terrible. You could literally pull a brick out of it. There was no floor, and I would always sort of daydream, like, man, I would do something really cool in there. You know, like, so every day I would have a different idea of what I would do in that building. And so I stopped in front of that building, and I'm like, take this building, for example. Like, it's just sitting here, rotting away. No one's taking care of it. This is an amazing building, and look at this house. And he's like, do you know something I don't know? I'm like, no, man, but this is insane, isn't it? Like, this could be this. And he's like, this is where I was bringing you.
Oh my God!
The investors just bought this. Which our investors are unbelievable people who provide us these incredible opportunities to take these buildings and put our dreams inside of them. You know, and we couldn't be luckier. I mean, it's unbelievable. And he's like, "Well, this is the guys just bought this, and they were thinking about turning it into offices. But I thought that maybe I saw a restaurant." And he said, what kind of restaurant do you see? And I took a look. Obviously, I had thought about it many times. And I said, that's a restaurant where you sit down and eat the best damn cornbread you've ever had in your life.
Mm.
You know, that's a Southern restaurant. And so we talked about that for a few days and threw many, many, many ideas around. And then, well, first of all, a lot of these guys are British. So, you know, I had to really sort of state my case, like, this is why it should be a Southern restaurant and not something else. So in order to do that properly, I had to really be able to answer the question, well, what is a Southern restaurant? What is Southern cuisine? What does that mean? So it was a really cool moment in my life because it really allowed me to take a step back and analyze how cuisines are formed and why certain things are the way that they are. And so once I was able to internally answer that question, what is Southern food? What is Southern cuisine? What's a Southern restaurant? Then I started, I made a list of the Southern restaurants in the South and even New York and wherever. And I started looking through the menus and thinking about their philosophies. And then it made me sort of realize that I needed to do something new, something exciting, and something that was important in ways more than just creating delicious food. How can I say this is Southern food and this is Southern culture, and look how beautiful it is? And so we decided that in order to do that, everything had to be Southern to the bone. You know, like, everything had to be about, everything had to tell a story about the South. In order to do that, you can only use Southern products. So we made this rule right off the bat. We can't buy anything unless it's below, produced below the Mason-Dixon line. And what that does is it really forces us, and it's quite challenging, but it forces us to push ourselves in new directions and to really think. So we change the menu twice a day, technically, once for lunch, once for dinner. We've changed those menus every single day since we've been open, and we cook off the cuff. It's like a jazz song, you know, it's like a jazz piece. We had a lot of challenges in the beginning. I mean, you know, when there's no food growing in the fields, what do you cook? So
what do you cook?
Well, preservation comes in, just like my childhood.
Mm.
You go to the mason jars, you know, you go to the freezer and you work with what you have, and that's taught me more about cooking than I could ever imagine. You know, think about if you go to the pantry at McCrady's, it's a fascinating place. You look around and there's food from all over the world. There's balsamic vinegar, there's soy sauce, there's fish sauce, there's katsuobushi, there's kelp, there's all these things from all around the world that we have at our fingertips to help us make food delicious and unique. Well, the one at Husk is very, very small. I mean, even think about vinegar, for example. Acid is very important to us in our cuisine. Well, obviously for pickling, but for seasoning, there aren't very many southern vinegars out there that are available to chefs to purchase. And the ones that we found, we bought everything they had and then used it in like a week. So that forced me to learn how to make vinegar properly. And now we have a research kitchen that has 50 different vinegars working in it. So it's really pushed us to be better chefs. I mean, like, we make our own salt, you know, we'll grind our own flour. It really pushes us to do things the old-fashioned way. It takes away that convenience factor. So it's really taught me a lot about cooking. And we do pretty much 98% live fire cooking at Husk. It's either smoked, cooked asado style, cooked in the wood-burning oven.
What's one of your favorite dishes of this week, since you're changing it all the time? Can you describe for us, you know, how you conceive a dish? And
yeah, for sure. You know, we knew that so many people were coming in town, and they were all going to be hungry for stories, and they were going to be hungry for that connection to the city and to the cuisine. So we had to be very careful about what we were cooking and make sure that everything had a story. So the menu right now is a lot of fun. It's kind of like a greatest hits album. You know, it's like all of our favorite dishes. And there's this dish that I love to death. It's called Brown Oyster Benny Stew, or Benny Brown Oyster Stew. And essentially it was a slave dish. It was using wild plants and wild oysters and leftovers. And so the story of the dish is pretty cool. It's an old recipe, and it's insanely delicious. We have a plant here that came from Africa around 1800 called Benny. And Benny's sort of...
B-E-N-N-E.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. And it's very similar to sesame. In fact, it's almost identical. But the sesame that we're used to tasting has a very high oil content because a lot of it's used for oil production. And over time, it's been engineered to produce more oil. But Benny... the Benny from Africa that we use here has very little oil, and so it's actually mostly protein, but the flavor is completely different. It's very earthy, it's very floral, it's pleasantly bitter. In fact, like when you eat it, when you chew it, mm-hmm. nothing happens for a second, and the more you chew, it's like, I call it the everlasting gobstopper. It's like you go through all these levels of flavor. So it's one of my favorite ingredients. And so it came into the South mainly for oil production. It was at a time where we were trying to find our oil or fat source. Olives, Thomas Jefferson had tried. Obviously, lard was very important. Crisco hadn't been invented yet. So we were trying all different
olives
ways.
Olives aren't grown in the South.
Absolutely. Right? We have olives growing in Husk.
You do?
Yeah.
So that it can take to this climate.
You know, I could sit here and talk for hours about olives in the South. I've researched it for a long time and followed its journey. And now there's some guys in Georgia that are producing some world-class olive oil.
Really? Wow.
It's fantastic.
So is that what you use at the...
Yeah, that's what we use at both restaurants, actually. We're big supporters of those guys, and we want more people in the South to grow olives, because 90% of the olive oil... I don't know if that's the correct stat, by the way, but let's say a figure like 90-some percent of the olive oil consumed in America comes from outside of America. So I think there's a big opportunity for Southern farmers, and I've got this crazy theory about it all, to really make in a huge production. But the Benny oil, once it's, they were using it for oil, so they would press it and extract the oil. And what's left are the seeds that have been mashed, and that gets dried and turned into what's called Benny cake flour, and it can be used like flour, and it has that sort of peanut butter, lavender, earth bitterness to it. And so the dish starts with lard, and then you stir in this Benny cake flour and make a roux. Cook it, and then you take the oysters and shuck them, drain them of their liquor, and you put the liquor in with a bit of stock, and you make a little stew, and then maybe sometimes some people put bacon in it or ham, and then you bring it up to a simmer, and once it tastes right, maybe season it with some lemon. Once it tastes delicious, then you drop your oysters in and slowly poach them, and then you serve that over rice or grits. It's almost like an oyster gravy, but it has that bitterness and that earthiness and that nuttiness from that Benny, and then you sprinkle Benny over the top.
That was a slave dish?
Because it was all scraps. You know, they would serve it over the broken rice, because that's what they would eat, because it wasn't good enough for the market, because everybody was very particular about rice at this time. So the broken rice they would use, and they would forage a lot of plants and garnish, you know, different wild herbs and things from the beach as well. And so it's so cool to have a dish that not only tells a story like that, but also is insanely delicious.
Whoa. So we're going to take a break right here. We're going to come right back and talk more to Sean Brock. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story. And today we're broadcasting from the Planters Inn in Charleston, South Carolina, during the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. And I have the privilege today of talking with Sean Brock, who is one of the most celebrated chefs of the South in America. And, you know, Sean, I'm very envious. I've been in the food field for 30 years. But, you know, you chef guys have a lot of fun. And you know what?
That's the only thing I'm good at.
I don't think so. I think, you know, James Beard Awards have decided you're good at other things, too. But... you know, I know there's this group of chefs, you know, Rene Redzepi and David Chang and you, and Daniel Patterson, and a bunch of you. You go off around the world. You were sort of in no man's land in Poland, foraging together and hanging out. What? Tell me about this group, and tell me how much fun it is.
Well,
give me an inside view. I was
extremely blessed to be included in Cook It Raw Japan last year. And Cook It Raw Japan in Japan.
Oh, Kick It Raw! Japan,
yeah.
Okay.
That too. And, you know, I'll never forget that phone call being invited and just like how my stomach felt and the excitement. And so the idea really is it's a field trip, and the idea is to teach each other and learn from new cultures and different cultures and unknown cuisines and cultures. And so you basically go visit an area and you explore it for a week, and you try and eat the local foods and hear the stories, and you visit with artists and you visit with the producers, and you really try and dig as deep as possible. You go hunting, you go fishing, you go foraging, you know, you go out and gather ingredients, and at the end of this field trip, you know, and every night everybody's just, it's just constant brainstorming and talking about what we've learned and how similar it is to what we do or how different it is to what we do. but we're also teaching each other, like, you know, and the conversations are what we're excited about that's going on in our kitchens. So it's a great opportunity to get together. But at the end of this week of discoveries, we all come up with a dish that's reflective of what we've learned, and serve it to some dinner guests. And it's just an amazing, life-changing experience. I mean, Japan, I've always wanted to go, and I love Japanese food, and I respect the culture so much, and I respect the cuisine so much. So it was an amazing opportunity to go there and really dig deep. And
so walk us through, what part of Japan did they take you to, and what was your dish at the end of the week, and what did you learn?
Well, we started off in Tokyo, and spent a couple of days there seeing the city, and that was just amazing. And then we went to Ishikawa Prefecture, which is kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's rice country. We really sort of, it's right there on the Sea of Japan, and so we hung out with salt producers, we hung out with sake masters, we hung out at soba houses. I went fishing with Anthony Bourdain in this little fishing village, this little peninsula, at 4 o'clock in the morning, and ate the fish right off the boat. We went foraging in this beautiful forest, and had this huge feast and gathered all these beautiful wild plants. It was just an amazing experience.
Were there Japanese chefs with you?
There were. In fact, Narisawa, he was with us. He just got number one on the 50 Best Asia list. So we had a great host, an amazing chef, and an extremely kind and humble human being. An incredible person. So my idea was, one of our activities was duck hunting, and I love duck hunting. But we hunt duck with guns in America. Mm-hmm. They hunt them with nets in Japan. Mm-hmm. They have this huge stick with like a V on the end, and it has a net, and you wait for these ducks to fly from one field to the next at sundown, and you kind of crouch and hide, and when they fly over, you jump up and you throw this huge net in the air, and hopefully a duck flies in it. So I was cooking duck. That was my, I took the duck, I was like, okay, I'll use what we get from the duck. We didn't catch any ducks. So I had to, you know, this is, you know, I'd already conceptualized a dish based around Carl Jung, actually, because what they did is they paired us each with an artist. So, for instance, Narisawa-san got paper, Magnus got fabric, Renee got glass, and I get this beautiful plate that was broken up into four sections. And it was all different angles, and so it really limited what I was able to do. I couldn't use a broth. I couldn't use a sauce. But then I started thinking, like, why four? Like, what does four mean? And then I'd recently been reading a lot about Carl Jung, and he was fascinated with quadrants and the number four. And so I started thinking, like, four seasons, you know, four directions, northeast, southwest, four this and four that, and, like, you know, started to make sense. And so I wanted to represent that in the dish, but we didn't catch the ducks, and that was like the air part of the whole Carl Jung dish. So I ended up using pork, which was incredibly delicious. Their pork was just amazing. And they used a bunch of wild plants I found. And they had one ingredient which I was very familiar with over there called a sweet potato. So I cooked sweet potatoes. But one thing that Carl Jung always talked about, like achieving fullness in life, was you had to circle the square. And so my dish was a square with a quadrant with all these things going on, but all these foraged plants, I made a circle with these herbs and lettuces and shoots on the plate. So there's an actual circle inside the square. So, you know, it worked out. And I was very, very happy with it. That was probably the most stressful dish I've ever had to create on the fly standing beside Alberta Audrey and Renee Redzepi and Magnus Nielsen and David Chang and Daniel Patterson. I was terrified. You know, I was completely terrified. But it's amazing what you can achieve when you're that scared. You know, that's intense motivation.
The beginning of the interview about pushing yourself.
Yeah, and some people, most people, aren't willing to take the sacrifices that come along with pushing like that.
Well, I think it's more than the sacrifices. I think it's the risk that scares people. So, future, vision, excitement, challenge to you. What does that look like?
I love cooking and I love being a chef, but you know, I'm not sure that I want to stand at the stove and cook catfish for the rest of my life. You know, I think I was put on Earth for many other reasons, and so for me, it's a lifetime of studying Southern culture, much in the same way that John T. Edge and the Southern Foodways Alliance have done. Really trying to be inspired by them and follow in their footsteps because I respect what they've done so much, and it's changed my life. So for me, you know, I see a lot of research and a lot of traveling and a lot of writing and a lot of teaching. That's what I love. You know, I just went to Africa, West Africa, to research low country dishes. And
whoa! So is this from the slave trade?
Exactly, the Atlantic slave. Yeah, and
tell
plants.
Me more about that.
And plants. I mean, you know, Charleston was a rice town, and rice grew here like crazy. And our particular variety of rice or rices, we actually had at one point, there were 100 varieties of rice being grown there in the low country. But it was a rice city, and it was built on rice, indigo, and cotton, actually. But rice was a very successful crop. And
We've got a little New York action out there with the fire department. I'm just going to close this door. But tell, so I guess the rice came from Africa, no? Originally,
well, we're still trying to find that answer, but a lot of people believe that it came from Africa or the West Indies. But regardless of where it came from, all of the people that worked those rice plantations, most of them were from West Africa. So they brought over specific plants and agricultural techniques and cooking techniques, and they taught us. And so if you try and understand what low country cuisine is, you have to understand what it took to grow rice, and you had to understand crop rotations, and you had to understand what each plant did and what its place was in the field. And then once you realize that, then you see those plants, things like benny, things like okra, things like sea island red peas, mm-hmm. things like corn, they all find their way into the pantry, into the kitchen. And so here's your pantry, these ingredients, and then you take the cultural influences of West African cuisine, their cooking techniques, their dishes, and you add those two things together, and you get low country cuisine. So a lot of our dishes.
How did you know where to go in West Africa?
Well, first of all, I wanted to go to a safe place.
Yes.
But I have a great friend who had some connections there, and knew some chefs and cooks, and that's kind of how the whole thing got started. And so I went there and cooked in people's homes and ate and just had some amazing conversations.
Did you see the connections?
Oh, it was so fascinating to see the original gumbo, the original jambalaya, the original Hop and John.
Oh, really? What's the original gumbo like?
The original gumbo looks exactly like ours, exactly to the T. Looks exactly the same, but ours has, or usually has, a lot of people make it differently, tomato and a dark roux. Both of those things aren't in West African gumbo, but it looks exactly the same, and the red color comes from palm oil. There's palm trees everywhere there, and everyone makes their own palm oil, and palm oil is sold everywhere, and it's this bright, it looks like Fanta strawberry soda or something. It's like this unnatural, crazy orange-red color. It has this really cool flavor. It's a flavor that I don't even know how to describe because I've never tasted anything like it before, so I don't have a reference. But it's very thick, and it almost has like sediment in it. So, and pulp. So they stir that in, and it gives it this really cool mouthfeel and texture. But it turns it that crazy bright red. And you know, no one really eats pork there. You know, a lot of the southern dishes, we get that umami, that depth of flavor from ham hocks, from country ham, from bacon, from fatback. Well, there, I was amazed to see how they achieve that umami and that depth and that richness. They use smoked and fermented shellfish and fish in its place.
Really, they get umami from that.
So, let's say you're searing lamb for a dish, where we may throw bacon in the pan, in the oil, just or a piece of fatback. They throw in fermented sea snails, or smoked oysters, or dried shrimp, or fermented locust bean gum, locust beans, and flavor the oil with that, and then take it out, and then roast the meat. Or if they're cooking rice, or you know maybe we would season it with ham hock, they would throw in a fermented clam, or smoked oyster, and get that umami from that. And when you eat it, it's almost exactly the same. There's no pork. So things like that were quite fascinating.
Wow. Well, I could go on forever, I think, talking to you. I've never met you before today, and I was really excited to meet this great chef. But I've also met an incredible storyteller and an incredible teacher.
Oh, thanks a lot.
I want to thank you so much.
My pleasure.
For coming by today.
Anytime. Thank you.
Okay. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And I want to give a shout out to our producers, Jack Inslee and Robin Cohen. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.